You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Welcome to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Monday, March 1st. It's also a great pleasure to be joined today by Ian Miller, who's a research associate at the MIT Energy Initiative. And we're going to talk today a little bit about energy issues, climate change, electric vehicles, and the timing, of course, of this conversation is very good, given the recent experience for folks in Texas have had with that unusual cold front that moved through and knocked out their electric grid and caused all kinds of problems for those folks there. But we're really glad to have Mr. Miller with us today to share some of his thinking about all of that. And Ian, thank you, first of all, for making the time for this conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me, Andrew. It is a pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, maybe we should start off then talking a little bit about what happened in Texas. And I guess the obvious question is, could it happen here? I mean, here in New England. You know, the Texas grid, which I didn't realize before all the attention began to be paid for it, is kind of a standalone operation, it sounds like. They're not connected in with the national grid to the extent that we have a national grid. I mean, was that a big part of their problem as you followed that situation to the extent that that's kind of like just an unusual thing? Or could a similar cold front or weather event like that knock out, the electrical system here in a similar way?
It could, but it's much less likely because Vermont and other northeastern states have taken steps to winterize or weatherize their power grids, their power lines, their steam towers at thermal power plants, among other equipment. Texas, you asked, you know, how unusual are they? They are exceptional in their disconnection from the neighboring power grids and neighboring states. And so, you know, the answer to your question is that did contribute to the problems because supply, right? They had a surge in demand for power, and the lack of connection to neighboring power grids did reduce their ability to call upon those neighbors for help. Now, how much better would it have been, you know, how if they had more connections, if they hadn't taken steps to disconnect decades ago to avoid or minimize federal regulation of their power grid is very hard for me to say, but it certainly would have been better. So that's the connection side of it. And then there's the winterization side of it. Whether you're connected or not to your neighbors, if a, you know, cold snap disables huge percents of your power grid's generation, you're going to have problems and blackouts. On this topic, there have been many takes, right? Some good takes and some bad takes, and some scrambling to shift blame to renewables and other areas that don't deserve much blame, in my view. I think that the number one cause was the lack of disaster prep. You could call it lack of disaster prep, lack of disaster insurance, but disaster insurance takes different forms, right? It could be additional investments to winterize Texas infrastructure. And that, of course, costs money and raises power prices. But it's the age-old question of, you know, how much regulation is needed to make sure private companies prepare for unlikely events or don't cut too many corners. I should say, you know, I'm not the world's expert in this, but one person who is a colleague of mine named Jesse Jenkins, and I highly recommend his writing on this topic, including in the New York Times.
Well, one of the other things that, you know, I found myself thinking about in the wake of that event, and it's certainly nothing new, is the whole connection with that situation that hopefully is now well on the mend down there, with the whole broader issue of climate change and conversion to greener energy sources like wind and solar and so forth. I guess I just wondered, you know, from your perspective, what do you see as the incentives, I guess, that are still needed to get in place in order to make that progress towards greener and more climate-friendly energy sources that are also reliable move more quickly? I mean, it sounds like the time frame, the time window for kind of getting our act together around this stuff seems to shrink and shrink and shrink all the time. And not so long ago, it seemed like, oh, we got like decades to kind of figure that out. And now all of a sudden, that doesn't seem like the case anymore.
Right. So hammers see nails, right? And what I mean by that is I'm an electric vehicle researcher, among other things. So when I think about energy resilience and our electricity distribution system, I tend to think of EVs as potentially assisting in making our systems more resilient. We can get into that more later, but on non-EV topics, right, for resilience in high renewable systems, I think that interregional connections are important, and incentives to flatten power loads are important. Those incentives could take different forms. They could involve time of use power pricing. Now, time of use power pricing is common in industrial and wholesale electricity markets, less so in residential, which is the bigger source of demand, but it's growing from a small base. California has started some large efforts at time of use power pricing, you know, where the power price can vary between hours of the day throughout the whole state. And that, I think, can provide real value in reducing peak loads that stress power grids and or require expensive investments to satisfy those peak power demands. Important note on that topic, though, is there are equity concerns. It's not as simple as just saying, oh, we need to price power supply, you know, for peak and off-peak times. One needs to consider, and regulators in California and other places are considering, how to make sure that doesn't unfairly penalize lower-income folks who perhaps are less flexible, have less ability to change the times of day when they use electricity. But I think California is proving, and other places have proven, that there are equitable ways to introduce more time hourly variance into power pricing that benefit the power grids and make them more resilient. As for the interregional connections, you know, Vermont, of course, knows this well regarding hydro and other power sources. Remind me, Andrew, do you know roughly the percent of Vermont's electricity consumption that comes from out of state? Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, off the top of my head, no. I know a lot of it comes from, most of the majority of it comes from Hydro-Quebec, the facility up there in Canada. That produces the lion's share, I'm sure, of the state's electricity. I mean, some of it used to come from the nuclear plant near Brattleboro, but that's been decommissioned. So I'm assuming that's well above 50% comes from out of state.
Right. So, okay. So Vermont's an example just, of a state that benefits greatly from interstate power connections. And interstate power connections additional ones can help resilience and renewable growth at lower cost. For example, as offshore wind grows, there is serious exploration of Great Lakes wind turbines, and whether those projects go forward or not, connections from the Midwest and its strong wind resources to states that don't have such resources locally can definitely facilitate both resilience and renewables growth.
Well, let's talk about electric vehicles there, since you mentioned them there a moment ago, and this is, I know, is an area of great interest for you. How critical is the role of electric vehicles, of which you've been hearing a fair amount about lately, particularly with the recent announcements from General Motors? I'm thinking indicating that they want to basically almost go completely to EV cars and trucks by the 2030s or 2040s. That certainly sounds like that would be a bit of a game changer in the whole industry, given the supply chain issues that are involved with that, and the different types of equipment that go into electric vehicles as opposed to fossil fuel powered cars. I guess, what do you see as the role of electric vehicles and transportation as part of the whole solution to coming up with a more greenish, climate-friendly, yet reliable energy structure? Do they have a critical role to play?
I think potentially, especially in the medium-long term, I think EVs can do great things for power grids and society more generally. And I'll elaborate a little what I mean in a second. But before I forget, I just wanted to mention one more thing on resilience super quick. And that is that I think what Texas demonstrates is that, another big remedy is just smart government regulation. And in Texas, it seems that they underplanned for disasters. They being the private entities making up the grid, conducted their planning around a 1 in 10 year weather event, a 1 in 10 year cold snap based on the 2011, I believe it was 2011, cold snap that Texas experienced. Part of the remedy, and there's multiple remedies that can work together, but part of it surely could be, the government saying, listen, we by law, need to require you to plan for a 1 in 50 year cold snap, or, setting that number is an important process, but surely it's more than 10. So that was just one remedy I wanted to make sure to mention. Jumping back to the EV question, right? I think that EV growth has a large potential to help power grids. What do I mean? One area of collaboration, call it, is vehicle to grid. And what that means, they call it vehicle to grid services sometimes, is what it sounds like. The vehicle's sending electricity to the power grid rather than just the opposite, right? Taking electricity from the power grid. The reason that can provide value is the same reason that any energy storage device can provide value to the power grid. It's the same reason that stationary batteries are getting more attention and investment for power grid applications. So, you know, the simplest example is the battery or other energy storage device that charges during off-peak times and discharges during peak times, right? And that simply helps, you know, reduces the need for other generation to be built, other power generation. Another way of saying it is that it flattens out the overall demand profile from midnight to midnight on an average day. So that's any energy storage device. And that can enable, you know, let's say wind power, for example. On average, it peaks overnight, right? There's a lot of daily, weekly variation, but on average throughout the US, wind power peaks in the overnight hours, let's say, you know, midnight to 4 a.m. And if you have energy storage, you know, soaking up that power during that off-peak time, which otherwise might not be needed, you know, by folks between midnight and 4 a.m., and then you can discharge it at 6 p.m. during peak times when folks get home in the evenings from work, that can, you know, help you integrate more renewables into power grids. Now, where electric vehicles come in is that they are batteries on wheels, right? And currently, vehicle to grid is negligible, but I'm convinced it is the future, and I want to help make it the future. I'd like to help businesses and others realize the potential of EVs to provide vehicle to grid services. So, for example, you know, let's put some numbers on it. If Bloomberg is correct about EV growth over the next 30 years to mid-century, and I think plausibly EVs could grow even faster than Bloomberg's current projection. You know, these things are uncertain and up to us to a degree. But if they are correct, the we're talking a 20% rise in power demand, or, you know, 20% of the country's electricity demand coming just from electric vehicles. If you crunch the numbers, that amounts to roughly a terawatt or 2 terawatts of power capacity in electric vehicles alone at mid-century. That is roughly the same power capacity as the entire US electric grid right now. So, of course, you know, all those EVs are never going to be plugged in for the same, you know, time of the day, doubling grid power capacity. But they can provide major services if two-way charging is allowed. That's a big if. Currently, if you tried to discharge your EV battery back to the power grid instead of just to power your wheels on the road, you would void your warranty for Tesla electric vehicles, for example. The reasons for that are interesting, but the takeaway is that that could change, and we should try to change that. We should try to facilitate the provision of vehicle-to-grid services so that we can flatten out power demand.
Do you think there's a likelihood that in the relatively near future, a couple of years from now, the price of EVs will begin to come down? I mean, I'm assuming the bulk of the cost of an EV is in the battery and the materials that go into it. I mean, that's another whole interesting question, the raw materials that go into making these batteries. But, you know, if production ramps up and economies of scale are possible, do you think the cost of an EV will come down even with or without a state or government incentive? I mean, right now, for instance, here in Vermont, there's a couple of you know, ways you can get credits that would lower the price of it, but they're still kind of well up there in the high 20s for you know, a fairly small vehicle, which kind of puts it out of the price range, I think, of a lot of folks. But any sense that that's on the horizon, some kind of decline?
The short answer is yes. Absolutely, I do expect EV prices to keep dropping. And it seems they're dropping every day, to be a little hyperbolic. I just had a call with a colleague, a fellow transportation researcher at Mighty, and they alerted me to the Chevy Bolt being available at $18,000 in the US. Wow. Now, don't take my word for it. We should do our Googling homework and confirmation. But if that's true, I assume it's partly because of government incentives. That is, you know, extremely affordable, extremely competitive with similar sized internal combustion gasoline vehicles. And Tesla's prices, right, on the higher end of EVs have decreased dramatically just in the last 5 years. Based on those drops, based on the things you mentioned, including economies of scale, based on battery investments, if you just look at some of the investment numbers, I think that total cost of ownership for EVs is very quickly going to become competitive and attractive to a much higher percent of U.S. consumers. Now, sticker price is not the only cost item, right? That's not the only cost that drivers and car buyers care about. There are, of course, fuel costs and range anxiety costs, if you want to call that. It certainly is a cost, right? In a world with zero EV chargers available, it doesn't matter if the Chevy Bolt is $100. No one's going to buy it, right? Now, in the real world with non-zero EVs available, non-zero chargers available, folks do buy. And you asked a question about the challenges that rural states like Vermont face when it comes to implementing or exploring expanded EV transportation. And I wanted to throw a question back at you related to perhaps there's a synergy, perhaps there's an opportunity that rural states like Vermont might have to a greater degree than more urban states. And to get at that, my question for you is, do you have any sense roughly what percent of Vermonters have park at home, have garages?
That have garages, period, versus ones with the ability to charge vehicles and stuff. I mean, it's a pretty rural state. Most folks live in small towns outside of, like, say, Burlington or some of the other larger cities. So I'm sure well over half of the state's population probably does have a garage or, a standalone home.
Okay. So that, I should rephrase. I mean, you saw through my lack of clarity. And what I mean is, what I'm wondering is what percent of car owners have, access to a electrical outlet overnight. And I think what you just said, as a rural state, Vermont's percent is higher than the U.S. average, right? Simply mm-hmm. because it's more rural than the U.S. average. And, there's less street parking than the U.S. average. And the reason I ask about that is because, I think for the U.S., it's something like 50%. 50% of cars have, are within 10 feet of an electrical outlet on a typical night, something like that.
About right, yeah.
And if it's significantly higher for Vermont, which I think it is, then, therefore, the charging bottleneck, the charging anxiety could be less of an obstacle for Vermont, less of an obstacle for, a more rural state. Now, the sticker price, that still remains a very important topic, and as do electricity prices. But if, a greater share of people are parking somewhere overnight, that it's easy for them to plug in and to charge slowly, right? We're talking about slow charging with minimal investment. You could use the wall outlet, which is called level one, or it's called slow charging. It takes a long time, but if you're sleeping, you don't care that it takes a long time, right? Or you could upgrade to a 240-volt charger, and that could, for a typical EV, let's say a Bolt, right, not as fancy as a Tesla, that'll get you from 0% charge to 100% charge roughly in, maybe 4-5 hours. Another important note is that no one's charging from 0 to 100, right? Even the Chevy Bolt has a range, I think, of, let's call it somewhere between 100 and 150 miles. The average U.S. car trip is 13 miles, right? So 1/10 of that. Now, Vermont is more rural, so I expect the average car trip in Vermont is higher, but it's not that much higher. It's not going to be 100 miles. It might be 30 miles just to, take a stab in the dark. That's still going to leave the car, rarely below half of fully charged if it's plugged in every night. That's one area Vermont could have an easier time adopting EVs.
That's an interesting change of pace, because it's as we mentioned before we went on. It seems like rural parts of the country always seem to wind up obtaining all these things somewhat later than other places in the country do. But I wanted to ask you about that, because that whole charging station question is one that's kind of fascinating in some ways. I mean, psychologically, I think what puts off a lot of people from thinking about buying an EV as their next car is that whole range anxiety issue you mentioned. That, and while even though the average drive might be 13 miles or 20 miles or whatever back and forth to work, pretty much everybody likes to think they have the option of going for a 200-mile drive someplace if they needed to for some reason. And then what happens when they're out in the middle of nowhere and their battery runs dead?
Sure.
Where are we at in terms of the technology for fast charging? I mean, comparable to driving into any gas station right now and filling up your tank in 10 or 15 minutes and being on your way to drive another 200 miles or wherever it is you would need to go. Are we at all close to having charging stations and equipment that you could plug into and at least, let's say, charge up half the battery and give yourself another 100 or so miles of capacity? Or is that still way, way, way down the road?
I don't have a great answer here, Andrew, to be frank. But I do have some answer, and that is that the technology is there, but the business models maybe not yet. And what I mean is fast charging technology, high voltage DC chargers, they exist, and Tesla has deployed many in their national network of charging stations, which I think is don't quote me on this, but I think it's around 15,000-17,000 stations, but I could be off by a factor of 10 there. Is it only 1,700? No, I think it's more. But in any case, my point is the tech is there, but actually making money off that as a charging business, as a standalone charging business, has not quite been figured out. Tesla essentially subsidizes their charging network internally, right? They take their profits from car sales and bundle their charging network as part of the Tesla purchase package. But other companies I think are struggling a little. That of course raises the question of government potential of government to help and to incentivize additional fast charging networks. On this is where I don't have a great answer, to be honest. I'm a little circumspect when utilities try to some utilities, right, are lobbying state and regional regulators to let them build charging stations. There's nothing too sinister here, but it's not sinister to point out that utilities in most places are legally able to pass those costs onto ratepayers like you and me, right? They have incentives to build infrastructure and then to pass their CapEx infrastructure investment costs onto electricity consumers like you and me in the form of higher rates plus some government guaranteed rate of return. That doesn't mean it's not worth it. It just means we need to keep that in mind and consider alternatives to utilities building fast charging infrastructure and passing the costs on to you and me. You know, what I'm suggesting is that it's at least worth considering that a socially optimal approach for the medium term, say 10 years, might not be a massive build out of charging infrastructure. It might be just, letting private companies build what they want to, and letting consumers purchase affordable electric vehicles and maybe not be able to do the longest road trips with them. I'm not saying that's satisfactory or long-term the goal, but if 84% of trips, you know, are under 20 miles, and that's roughly the number, and most Americans already own, most car owners own multiple cars, it might be a good thing and a massive emissions reducer for, you know, one of those two cars to be EVs, even if the fast charging infrastructure doesn't grow enough to allow that, 200-mile trip from, or that, anyway, that long trip from New York to Boston and back, let's say. Then again, you know, a busy corridor like that's a place that's most likely to have fast charging infrastructure built. But whether it's satisfactory and whether the lines are always short enough when you want them to be, say around the holidays, is a separate question. So I hope that provided some insight, even though I know it's not enough.
Well, no, it's fascinating. It really is interesting to see the range of issues that will begin to come up as electric vehicles become more popular and more prolific out there. I mean, there's just so many aspects to this, the manufacturing side of it, how that will change, what parts will be needed for cars, what job opportunities are available. I'm sure those are all going to be large adjustments that the whole car industry will have to make to adapt to this. But it's quite clear that, as we said earlier, the electric vehicle adoption will definitely be a key component to managing reducing carbon emissions. I mean, here in Vermont, the state legislature passed a statute last year that, and then overrode a gubernatorial veto to reduce carbon emissions by what sound like very ambitious levels to me. 26% below 2005 levels by 2025, and 40% below 1990 levels by 2030.
Interesting.
And if the government fails to meet, the state government fails to meet those goals, the bill allows individuals to sue the state to force it into compliance. Now, I don't know exactly how much that translates into in terms of tons of carbon emissions, but that sounds like a lot. And the numbers I've seen indicate that transportation issues are a big part of that, the whole total package of carbon emissions the state pursues. I mean, we could talk about things like electric buses and even electric garbage trucks I've been hearing about lately. Apparently they're very expensive. But it just makes it seem like the only way to get to from here to there is by really increasing by a wide number the adoption of electric vehicles.
I think you're absolutely right. And one question for you is, you said the goal of that legislation included by 2030, did you say a 26% drop from 1990 levels?
Below 2005 levels. By 26% below 2005 levels by 2025, 40% below 1990 levels by 2030, and then 80% below those 1990 levels by the year 2050.
And that's okay. Okay.
Out there, that it's hard to know what our shot is at that. But just that first one there, the 26% below 2005 levels by 2025, seems pretty ambitious, because in the last couple of years, those emissions levels have actually increased. They're not right now trending in the right direction.
Okay. Okay.
Until the pandemic came along and people stopped using their cars so much.
Sure, but that's, you know, right.
But that's a kind of an unusual, I'm assuming a one-off kind of thing. But anyway.
Sure, sure. So 40% below 1990, and For the U.S., passenger vehicles produce roughly 20% of net GHG emissions. If you move to non-net, it's something like 17. But for Vermont, I expect that's higher simply because it's more rural. You don't happen to know the percent for passenger transport, right?
Well, not off the top of my head, no. I'm sure that it's fairly significant. I mean, I would imagine that's, again, the majority of that that number.
Right. So it's definitely going to be significantly bigger than the U.S. average of 20%. And, you know, and therefore, perhaps Vermont could have an easier time meeting its decarbonization goals than other regions, because transportation decarbonization should be easier and more affordable than some other sectors. Transportation and electrification, like we've been talking about, have this this synergy, this potential to decarbonize alongside each other, right? So that when you buy that gasoline vehicle today, you're locking in those tailpipe emissions, both carbon and particulate, for the lifetime of the car, right? 10 to 20 years. Whereas you buy that EV in Vermont, it's already much lower emission per mile than your gasoline cars. And that emissions advantage grows year after year if the power grid is also decarbonizing, which is clearly part of Vermont's plan. Right.
Let me ask you one final question before we have to go. What are your thoughts about a carbon tax? I mean, that's been another hot political potato here, and I'm sure elsewhere as well. I mean, thinking back about 15 years or so, that seemed to be a fairly popular idea among conservative economists as the way to go if you wanted to really make meaningful reductions in use of fossil fuels. The obvious answer is raise the price, and people will use less of it, and other alternatives will emerge. But carbon tax has proven fairly unpopular, I guess, to say the least, when people go, what do you mean I'm going to spend $10 for a gallon of gas instead of $2.50 or whatever it may be now?
Sure.
That's kind of a non-starter very quickly. But even when it's packaged with an offset of some sort, so that low-income folks at least would not get as badly hammered by that increase in the price. But ultimately, I've long felt that, you know, a carbon tax of some sort or another probably is the most, well, it will be part of the solution in some way or another if there's enough political will gathered around the whole green energy idea in the first place that, gee, we really are running out of time to kind of solve, you know, climate-related problems. EVs are a big part of that. And one way we're going to push the growth of that is to make the price of gasoline just uncompetitive.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, or at least with some things you said there. A big part of me loves a carbon tax, loves technology neutral measures that do put a price on the externality of emissions and don't favor any particular technology or means of getting there. Carbon taxes are not the only technology neutral approach to putting prices on emissions, or at least there are other somewhat tech neutral approaches like efficiency standards, right? So efficiency standards take different forms, right? They could be fuel, car efficiency standards, i.e. CAF or, you know, fuel economy requirements. They could be, you know, they apply to appliances as well, of course. And, you know, basically there are different ways of making, you know, emissions more costly for the emitter. You're right, right? People hear tax and they run for the hills, but that can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think that there is real potential for carbon taxes with measures to ensure equity and ensure lower income folks don't get hammered, because as you mentioned, you know, a greater share of their income does go to things like gasoline. But there are ways of tackling that, and some regions have. And, you know, the similar issue arises with time of use pricing. I do strongly support that. The Nixonin Center, if you're familiar or not, has done some good work on the nuts and bolts of growing support for carbon taxes. In realistic ways, because of course special interests don't love broad-based taxes that have, you know, diffuse benefits and diffuse costs. They want concentrated benefits. They want subsidies for their particular industry on average. Again, not sinister, just to say that there are strong incentives for any power sector, whether it's fossil fuels or solar, to always see continued subsidies as a good thing. And you have to, you know, ask at a point, when would a carbon tax or cap and trade be better for society? And we've seen cap and trade have massive success in reducing particulate emissions and SOx and NOx, you know, partly thanks to folks like H.W. Bush back in, you know, yesteryear. And if we could get a hint of bipartisan support for a carbon tax, you might think I just contradicted myself. That's an oxymoron, bipartisan support for a new tax. then there could be real emission benefits for society. So, you know.
Well, we'll have to wait and see and keep our fingers crossed or whatever, I guess. But Ian, I guess we'll have to leave it there for today. I just want to again thank you very much for making the time to share your thoughts about the subject with us. Well, we'll see how it goes. It'll be an interesting year. So Ian Miller, a research associate at the MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology Energy Initiative. Thanks again for being with us. And we're going to have to bring you back again another time to give us the update.
Thanks so much, Andrew. It's been great talking. I'm optimistic about EV's growth and the potential for Vermont to benefit from that growth from an emissions and cost point of view. So thanks so much for the combo.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. And thanks to all of you for staying with us today. Hope you found the show interesting, and we'll see you again the next time. For today, this has been the GNet TV News Project. I'm Andrew McKeever. See you next time.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.